Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Helltown. ...1969, the age of Aquarius. Peace, love, and understanding. Nowhere was this more evident than in Helltown, also known as Provincetown, Massachusetts. And Tony Costa was at the center of it all. Like Charles Manson on the left coast, Tony had a group of loyal followers, mostly smitten women who called him Sire. Tony was the undisputed leader of their counterculture movement, the charming man who speaks eloquently and hands out hallucinogenic drugs like candy. But beneath his benign persona lurked a twisted and uncontrollable rage that threatened to break loose at any moment. Tony Costa is the most dangerous man on Cape Cod, and no one who crosses his path is safe. When young women begin to disappear, Costa's natural charisma and good looks initially protect him from suspicion. But as the bodies are discovered, the police close in on him as the key suspect. Meanwhile, local writers Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and Norman Mailer are locked in a desperate race to secure their legacies as great literary icons. Helltown, written by New York Times best-selling author Casey Sherman, is a landmark true crime narrative that transports us back to the turbulent late 1960s. And Mr. Sherman joins me now. Welcome, Casey.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's start, the best thing to start with, where does the title Helltown come from?
That's a great question. It actually is a nickname for the village of Provincetown on the tip of Cape Cod. And, back in the 1700s, that area was nicknamed Helltown for all the, quote, helling that was going on there, because it was really a hideaway for pirates and rocking tours back in the, late 1700s, early 1800s. And I think that nickname has stuck with the area, and that area, I think, still, pays homage to, the renegade lifestyle of pirates back in the, 18th century. So it's that's where the title comes from.
One of the things that drew me to the book was that it's not just a murder mystery. You cover it from several different standpoints, but Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Actually come into this story, and which is fascinating. But it is heinous murders that happened in the hippie scene in the 60s in Provincetown. So before we get into Mailer and Vonnegut, just a little background on the crime. It was disappearing young ladies at first, so they at first didn't know they were dead. And then, of course, the discovery. So let's start with the discovery of the crimes.
Early 1969, January to be exact, as I am being birthed at Cape Cod Hospital, Jim. I was born on January 19th, 1969. Two young women from Providence, Rhode Island, Pat Walsh, Marianne Wysocki. Pat was a elementary school teacher. Marianne was a college student. They wanted to break away from a very cold, frigid weekend in Providence, and they decided to travel to Provincetown. They'd been there several times in the past. They loved the vibe of that little village, and this was off-season. So it was a little quieter in January than it would be, say, in July, and they decided to take Pat's VW bug and drive to Provincetown and spend a couple days there. Walking down Commercial Street in Provincetown, having, drinks and food at local restaurants. And they booked themselves at a rooming house on Standish Street in Provincetown. And they never went home. The two women ended up missing, and that triggered a massive police manhunt, not only for any evidence of their disappearances, but also for the evidence relating to other women who had gone missing in Provincetown beginning in 1968. And ultimately, there was a serial killer on the loose. Now, Jim, as an investigative journalist, I've covered well over 100 homicides in my career, including the Boston Strangler case. Now, I have never seen anything as brutal as the crimes that I had to write about in the book Helltown. This was a serial killer that I would say had, grisly purposes and a mean demeanor that no one had seen since Jack the Ripper was stalking women in East London back in 1888. Not only were these victims murdered, but they were also dismembered and stacked upon each other's body parts and buried in shallow graves on the Outer Cape. And the killer at large was a young so-called cannibal named Tony Costa, who was a hippie messiah at the time, very reminiscent in comparison to Charles Manson. And it's interesting, Jim, that Charles Manson and Tony Costa were kind of two young men, born from the same cloth, if you will. While Charles Manson is building a kind of a small criminal empire in Southern California, Tony Costa is doing the same thing on the other side of the United States in Provincetown. Now, one thing that your listeners will find interesting is that they had both lived in San Francisco in 1967 during the Summer of Love. And Tony Costa went back to Cape Cod while Charles Manson migrated south. Now, I don't know if they ever shared intelligence with regard to their evolvement of being the killers that they eventually would become. But it's interesting that they were breathing the same air. So Tony Costa gets back to Cape Cod. It's the bleak winter winter months of 1969. And he just happens to be living in the rooming house where these two young women booked two nights. Now, Tony Costa also was an amateur taxidermist as well, which must be mentioned. Now, I compare him not only to Charles Manson, but also to Norman Bates in Psycho. He is the real life version of Norman Bates, where he's studying taxidermy because he's going to use those techniques to dismember and, hide the bodies of his victims. You know, as Charles Manson was grooming young women to serve him in Southern California, Tony Costa was doing the same thing in Provincetown. And he was doing it through the drug culture. These young women really worshipped, Tony Costa. And, they were somewhat complicit in his crimes. And, I wasn't chasing ghosts here when I was writing about Helltown. You know, some of those people still are around to this day. When the book Helltown first came out in 2022, I had a book event scheduled in Provincetown, which was abruptly canceled because the bookseller was getting threatened by members of the killer's family and members of, his so-called cult. So they're still there to this day.
Now, Let's talk about, first of all, I always tell this of my listeners that we can't cover the texture and wonder of any book I cover on my podcast. So they, and yours are no exception, that they must get the book. So we are touching on things to whet their appetite. So let's talk a little bit about how did the authorities come on to him, because for a while he was obviously not a suspect. What finally, got him in trouble, if you will?
Well, I think he got himself in trouble because he really played a cat and mouse game with state police during that time. So he thought he was smarter than any investigator that. And ultimately, shoddy police work at the beginning of the case. But as the case evolved and a couple of state troopers really took ownership of the investigation, you know, they were able to track Tony's movements, you know, all throughout New England and New York City. And ultimately, decisions that he made, you know, led to his shocking arrest.
And one of the things that comes out early on in investigations and even through the trial is his alter ego,
right?
Which is fascinating. He, again, in your book, and we'll tell, we are going to tell the audience a little bit about his book, Resurrection, and, you know, some of your sources for this information, but he had an alter ego that he actually talked to, in his mind. He was having battles, if you will, between himself. Am I sort of doing that accurately?
You're doing that. You know, that's a great summary of kind of what was going through Tony Costa's mind during the time. After his arrest, he was studied by a team of psychiatrists, and they determined that, he was a victim of ego splitting, meaning he did have a split personality that he named Corey Devereaux. And he was able to blame Corey Devereaux on his murderous deeds. Now, you mentioned, Jim, the manuscript Resurrection. Now, that is a unpublished book that the killer had written, via a typewriter at Walpole State Prison after he was convicted. And it never went to press. I did get a copy of it. So, you know, the reader for the first time, you know, I'm able to bring the reader into Tony Costa's murders through his eyes, because he's describing it in very vivid detail, which, you know, you wouldn't get anywhere else.
Now, as interesting as a split ego is, the case just gets stranger and stranger. This Corey Devereaux was a real person.
He was a real person. He was a high school student in Provincetown, kind of a small town drug dealer at the time, but not a homicidal maniac that Tony Costa was. Tony Costa was friends with a real life Corey Devereaux, and Corey Devereaux never knew that, you know, Tony had created an image of Corey in his mind to again blame all of these heinous murders on.
And in essence, then he gets dragged in, the real Corey Devereaux, because he's being blamed that he bought the gun, or he did this to this car, or he did this to this woman. And so the police obviously have to follow up on that. He's not saying he's in my head. He said, no, I didn't do it. Corey did it. No, and technically in his head, Corey did it, but there's a real Corey. Please help me with this.
Yeah, well, it's a labyrinth if you kind of walk through Tony Costa's very drug-addled mind at the time, because he was on a lot of psychotropic drugs while he was committing these murders. And I think that here's poor Corey Devereaux, who gets not only questioned by police but submits to a polygraph test, which he passes. And fortunately for Corey, he was able to get his freedom and maintain his freedom, because all of the evidence was stacked against Tony Costa. And when Tony Costa went to trial, now it was one of the most sensational trials, I think, in American history, where there were, topics that were being discussed in open court in 1970 that had not been discussed in any other, respectable forum. So, you know, jurors and bystanders and spectators are hearing this graphic, brutal testimony about what happened to these young women. And it's, as I mentioned, you know, Patricia Walsh, Marianne Wysocki, Sidney Monson, Susan Perry. You know, these weren't just statistics and names. These were real young women. And, you know, part of what I wanted to do when I wrote Helltown was to try to give them their power back and to show the reader who they were and what a tragic loss it was when Tony Costa murdered them.
And two of the young ladies, again, go back to where I'm living in Providence, Rhode Island. One of them, their funeral is at a church I go to, St. Paul's. And, you know, when I heard that, I went, oh, my God, that's where I go to church. I'm around the corner from it. And I don't know about the other two names. I forget now. It's been a while since I've read the book. But I know the two young ladies, at least, that were coming down there for a nice weekend, they were not prostitutes.
Yeah. I mean, these weren't, you know, ladies of the evening or sex workers, as in the Jack the Ripper case and some other serial murder cases. These were all, you know, teenage women, young women in the Cape Cod area or in the Providence, Rhode Island area. They all had hopes and dreams. They all had, you know, careers that they were looking forward to, and their futures were snuffed out by a sadistic killer who not only murdered them, but, as I said, dismembered their bodies, buried them in shallow graves. And when they were recovered by police officers who literally had to dig into frozen ground. And imagine being at that scene where these investigators discover limbs and body parts. And they didn't really know what they were looking at the time until, you know, that all of that evidence and those remains were brought, you know, to the mortuary for examination. As I said, if you know my background, Helltown was my 16th book. I've written a lot about true crime, but I've never seen anything like this. You know, having access to all of the crime scene photos, the autopsy photos, they were terrifying. And oftentimes I would have to pull myself away from the writing project because I had nightmares. And I'm a pretty, cold investigator, meaning I've seen it all, but I'd never seen anything like this. And those women stay with me to this day, Jim. And, you know, earlier you mentioned, you know, the subplot of Helltown, which is the journalistic rivalry between two, you know, iconic authors, Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut, which I was really fascinated with in terms of exploring, because as a writer, you know, I always like to find out what makes other writers tick. And there was darkness in both Vonnegut and Mailer. And both of them at the time were at different levels of their career, meaning Norman Mailer, and for those of you who don't remember who Norman Mailer was, he was basically the heir apparent of Ernest Hemingway in the 1960s. That's how famous Norman Mailer was. Best-selling author since his, since he was in his 20s, and was really a giant figure in literature in 1969. And he was living in Provincetown at the time. And then you've got Kurt Vonnegut living a few miles down the road in Barnstable. And Kurt is working at a Saab dealership, which he manages. So Kurt Vonnegut's got this story rattling around in his head about his time as a prisoner of war in Germany during World War II, which would ultimately become Slaughterhouse-Five, you know, one of the most iconic books of the 20th century. But in 1969, he's not that Kurt Vonnegut. He is a former crime reporter who stumbles upon this murder case on the Outer Cape. And both he and Mailer are basically in competition together to see who can write this story first.
And if I remember correctly, at least Vonnegut actually... Vonnegut actually interviews Costa?
Yeah. Vonnegut got pretty close to Tony Costa. And that was really unique to me. And I think, you know, Mailer, for his side, was really exploring, you know, the subculture of cults satanic cults that were not only prevalent, in Los Angeles and New York City, but also on Cape Cod at the time. And Mailer would eventually fictionalize the story in a bestseller that he wrote in the 1980s called Tough Guys Don't Dance. So the reader in this for Helltown is really going to not only explore a sensational serial murder case unlike anything they've ever read before, but also go on a journey with two authors.
But one of the things that I liked that I pulled out from it was that when Vonnegut realized that Tony was the guy, was when he told him, "I am the wolf of the steppes." What does that mean?
Well, that was, Tony Costa, thought of himself as a writer. So there is that common thread that I weave through the pages of Helltown. And he was a big fan of Hermann Hesse and utilized some of that language of Hesse's, most popular novels at the time to, explain or try to explain to Vonnegut, who he was. And I think at that point, Kurt understood that he wasn't just conversing with a young hippie messiah. He was conversing with a serial killer.
Now, the other texture of the time, and we'll get into a couple of things here, which are fascinating. You do cover the police, which are great. You cover the Trooper Tom Gunnery, and District Attorney Ed Denise, who was a bit of a publicity hound. And he, so I believe he was embellishing. I mean, these crimes need no embellishment, but he was talking about cutting hearts out or something. And
oh, yeah. When he got in front of the cameras, Jim, he started to call Tony Costa a vampire and a cannibal and talked about, Costa cutting out the hearts of his victims. And again, if you read the graphic testimony that I include in the book, that these murders do not need any embellishment. But, Ed Denise was looking to really become a national political figure. Now, I also weave in, 1969 was such a unique year in American history, and it kind of reminds me of where we are today. In 1969, the summer of love is long gone. Now you've got two assassinations, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. You've got the very violent protests at the Chicago Democratic National Convention. You've got Vietnam, and then you've got the inauguration of Richard Nixon. Also that year, you have Chappaquiddick, which is Senator Ted Kennedy's ill-fated trip over a bridge on Martha's Vineyard that killed a young woman named Mary Jo Kopechne. Ed Denise was the district attorney in that case, and it was all unfolding while he was also investigating Tony Costa. And why I included, a full chapter on Chappaquiddick, at first there was going to be a paragraph or two, but then I got the grand jury minutes of Chappaquiddick, and I was absolutely stunned, at what had happened to Mary Jo Kopechne. And it showed me that young women in 1969 and 1970 had little value and in a masculine society. And that breaks my heart. Those who read Helltown are going to have a full understanding of what happened to Mary Jo Kopechne, in the back of Ted Kennedy's car that night. And she didn't drown. She was asphyxiated. And Ted Kennedy had every moment, every opportunity to save her, and he didn't. So weaving those threads into ultimately what became Helltown was pretty interesting to me because it gave me a big landscape, for which to paint this story on.
And one of the things that did fascinate me is I turned to that page because I did not expect to find that. I mean, I, certainly was around when it was happening, read the papers, but it's been, years and years since. Sure. And just the detail that you give. And again, I'll leave that to the reader. They must pick up the book because, as you said, you have details that you were able. We have the newspaper, the quick little paragraph from the New York Times or Wikipedia. And the tragic events at Chappaquiddick certainly ended Ted Kennedy's political career.
You mentioned, the Wikipedias and things like that and the quick hits in the media. It's really, I benefit from all the primary source documents that, I can gather during a journey like this. I call myself an archaeologist of words. It's the digging that I really enjoy. The writing I obviously love, but you know, finding out something that I didn't know and then having the opportunity to share that with millions of readers around the world is a great pleasure for me.
Now, one other person at this point that I do want, before we leave, and we're going to, you know, talk about the trial, because my other, you know, life is theater. I was fascinated by Evelyn Lawson. So tell us a little bit about Evelyn Lawson.
She's a great character in the book. She's a theater critic on Cape Cod, and she was the only one who was really following and covering this serial murder case of Tony Koster, and she was putting all the pieces together. And once I learned a little bit about Evelyn, because she had passed away, you know, several years ago, but, you know, going through a lot of her old columns in these small community newspapers on Cape Cod, I was like, God, this woman is spot on. And then talking to people that knew her, and what a really larger than life character that Evelyn was, I thought, this is a perfect character for this book. And I was able to, you know, weave in her conversations with Norman Mailer, for example. So she's a great voice, I think, for the reader to really follow in the pages of Helltown.
And just again, I got a smile on my face to realize that she started the Provincetown Playhouse.
She started the Provincetown Playhouse, and that was her, you know, that was her bread and butter. She was, you know, the grand dame of theater on Cape Cod, which is a pretty lofty title to have, because obviously Provincetown and the Cape Playhouse and Dennis, these are really respectable and historic theaters.
And she just sounded like a delightful person that I would have liked to sit down and have a cup of coffee with. All right, well, let's leave the fun parts. Let's wrap up with the trial and the conviction and what happened to Tony after that.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, there was a sensational trial on Cape Cod, something that, you know, testimony in that trial was unlike anything else that had ever been committed to a courtroom on Cape Cod or really anywhere else. And it was, you know, a massive media event while it was happening. You had a lot of Tony's, you know, hippie, followers out there watching every step of the trial. You know, Tony Costa's, you know, wife, Avis, testified. There was a lot of really unusual testimony, not only about murder, but about the drug culture in the 1960s. And Tony Costa does address the jury, you know, in a late point at his trial, and we'll let the reader listen or read what Tony said at that time. But it wasn't enough to get his acquittal. Tony Costa was sentenced to life in prison at Walpole State Prison, and you know, spent the remainder of his days there until he committed suicide there a few years later. And you know, that's kind of where the book has this unique moment of, you know, again, you know, using the Vonnegut and Mailer tradition of new journalism, you know, creating some events and weaving in your Truman Capote theorizing into the story. You know, I was able to bring some current events into that particular piece of history as well.
So, again, I do want to tell my audience that we've scratched the surface of this book, which is Helltown, written by Casey Sherman. And you can get it everywhere. My wife tells me, you see the books behind me, I can't buy any more books. So mine was from the library.
Well, if you see the books behind me, it's the same thing. And, you know, Helltown is now, we're in development for a limited series for Amazon Studios. So we've got Oscar Isaac, the great Oscar Isaac, playing Kurt Vonnegut in our series. Edward Berger, who just won several Oscars for All Quiet on the Western Front, he's our director. My producing partners on this project are Team Downey, owned by Robert Downey Jr. and his wife, Susan. So, you know, it's a real, a heavy group of very talented people that are collaborating on taking and adapting my book onto the small screen. And we hope to begin shooting the series later this year.
Well, again, based on just, it is, some of the books are that I do are very literary. This reads like a movie. You just keep jumping from the, you're taking the reader from here to there to the next thing. And as I said, when you start throwing in characters, it's not just a murder story. All of a sudden, now we've got, excuse me, Norman Mailer. And okay, fine. All right. That's fine. Well, again, I want to thank you, Casey, for spending some time with us today. Again, the book is Helltown and soon to be a series, but go out and get it now. It can be your companion while you're watching the program. Thank you so much, Casey.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it.
So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.